All right, I'm just going to start the recording here, and I'm just going to count down and do a little goofy intro. And if I say anything wrong when I introduce you, then just say, hey, asshole, you got that wrong.
All right.
What was he wearing? Well, he was wearing a red Argyle sweater and tan trousers and red shoes. No, he's not retarded.
Ago in the spring of 2004, the Red Sox were fielding a team that included the likes of Curt Schilling, Cesar Crespo, Mark Bellhorn, and Pokey Reese. We didn't know quite what to expect that year, but we knew that we needed something to wash the memory of the 2003 ALCS from our collective minds. Fast forward to today, we've seen the Boston Red Sox win the World Series three times, which is something that I often have to remind myself actually happened. And to recognize the 10-year anniversary of the greatest Red Sox season ever, Surviving Grady will be talking to some notable local fans about how far we've come through the looking glass and how our world has changed since the Aaron Boone home run. To kick off this series, I'm happy to have someone who I can best describe, as a true Renaissance man. He's a member of one of my favorite bands, Buffalo Tom, who'll be playing the Paradise in Boston on June 21st. He's also an author of two books on the Rolling Stones, the most recent being Rocks Off, 50 Tracks That Tell the Story of the Rolling Stones. He blogs at his website, Part Time Man of Rock, an expert on local real estate and modern architecture. Perhaps most importantly, he's a Red Sox fan and has been a mainstay of Peter Gammon's Hot Stove Cool Music charity shows since their inception. And he's also one of the few people in the world who can claim to have shared a stage with Eddie Vedder and Theo Epstein. Bill Janovitz is our guest on this Surviving Grady podcast. And Bill, I thank you very much for taking the time to join our podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Tim.
And truly, I pretty much got to be the only guy to share a stage with Eddie Vedder and Theo Epstein. I can't imagine the list is that long.
Well, except for the other guys at Pearl Jam, yeah.
Before we take a trip down memory lane to 2003, I did want to ask, I just talked about the Hot Stove Cool Music charity, and you've been doing that, and that's been obviously a great charity endeavor for the city of Boston, for Theo Epstein and his foundation to be named later, lots of concerts, lots of tie-ins with the Red Sox. Can you just talk a little bit about how you first got involved with that? Because you're kind of like buds with Peter Gammons, essentially, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, over those, 13 or 14 years at this point or whatever it's been, we've gotten quite close. I mean, I don't see him as often as I'd like to, but, you know, he leads a very different life than I do. how I got involved is, it sort of traces my interest in the Red Sox as well. I mean, it was really in sort of the late 90s that I started to get really into the Red Sox. I'm not from around here. I grew up as a Mets fan down in Long Island, and so I had sort of this DMZ time, like around 86 when they were playing each other, that I was at college and I wasn't really paying much attention to baseball at all. And if anything, I was rooting possibly for the Mets at that time, though I had been in Boston for 4 years, or in Massachusetts anyway. Right around 99, my daughter was born. I started getting really into the games. I had already been getting into the games since the mid-90s, but I was really at home now with my daughter. She was born in April, so I remember watching every game in that 99 season, and just really, you know, sort of becoming, I guess, more public about it at gigs and things like that. People started to understand that I was really into it. So somebody named Jeff Horrigan, who you probably know, who used to write for the Herald, the beat writer, he's really one of the three prongs that founded Hot Stove Cool Music. You know, so he was a big Letters to Cleo fan, a big Buffalo Tom fan, and eventually a big Dropkick Murphys fan. I'm not sure if they were quite, I guess they were around at that time already. He knew Peter Gammons very well. He knew a lot of the players because he was a beat writer, and he was a big music fan. So I think between him and Michael Creamer and Peter Gammons, you know, as Peter often says, a lot of sports guys have their charity golf tournaments. He doesn't golf, so he's a rock and roller. So this was this was his idea to put these bands together. I actually missed the very, very first one when they had the bands Carlton Fisk fighting the other bands. Thurman Munson. There were two bands, Carlton Fisk and Thurman Munson. And they actually had a true fight, I'm told, as legend has it.
As would be expected.
Yeah, and they weren't just fulfilling their names. I mean, I think they actually had some animosity for each other. So I missed the very first one, but I was brought in for the second one and have played a part. Some years bigger, some years smaller, both musically and in an organizational way ever since. And I couldn't imagine missing a Boston event for Hot Stove Cool Music. It's actually kind of like a family holiday for all of us involved.
And I've been to a number of the shows, and it's always interesting to see the mix of local musicians such as yourself, Kay Hanley, and then to see, you'll see Tim Wakefield up there with a guitar, or a Lenny DiNardo, or someone. It's always an interesting mix of folks you see up there, which I think is what makes those concerts kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, some of my favorite photos are of Tim Wakefield and I, like out of the Fenway edition, when we actually were out in Fenway for a summer edition. Me and Papelbon singing It's Only Rock and Roll behind Juliana Hatfield. I mean, just crazy stuff. I mean, if I miss any one thing, a lot of the Hot Stoves recently, since Theo sort of came and went, because Theo, this thing predates Theo, in fact, you know. So we've missed a lot of the player involvement over the last few years. I mean, Euclid was still there when he was here. But it's you know, we don't have somebody in the locker room right now. We don't have somebody in the Red Sox organization. So it's more of a challenge to get the players to show up.
Looking at some of the crazy bastards on the 2013 team, that might be could be a certain element of danger that comes with them, I'm thinking.
But I feel like they were perfect because they were like Dirt Dogs Part 2, right? The Idiots Part 2.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe we'll get them next year.
I see a Mike Napoli duet in the future. That's something that's...
Jeez, Napoli shirtless and smoking outside the Paradise?
If that's not rock and roll, then what is? I mean,
no, absolutely, you know?
All right, well, I would like to now go back in time, go back to October 16th, 2003, and talk about the 2003 ALCS. Game 7 of the 2003 ALCS, I've written about that extensively. It's really what prompted me to create this blog, because I really did spiral after that. I'm not ashamed to say it, and I've written about it. It's been very therapeutic to get to blog about it. It really was it was almost like like losing a family member, a loved one. It was a horrific experience for me and for countless other people. And I remember being hauled up in a hotel room in New Jersey, and it was just brutal. It was just one of those things you think back on, and I still shudder when I think about it. But not to dredge up any bad memories from the past, but I'd like to ask you where you were when the Red Sox infamously lost the 2003 ALCS on the Aaron Boone home run. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was home, and my casual Red Sox fan wife had she goes to bed around this time. It was like 9 o'clock. She goes to bed very early. We need different schedules. But she was on her way up, and I said, hold on a second. Don't go up yet, because Trot Nixon's up, and he owns this guy, you know. It was Clemens, right? It was it was Trot and Clemens. And she said, okay. So she stood there by the TV, and what happens? Trot hits that home run, and I'm jumping up and down, and this is like, yes, you know. And she goes to bed, and the game starts to fall apart as it did. And she came downstairs in between innings when Wakefield was coming out, and you know, you're not going to find a bigger Tim Wakefield fan than I, but it just felt lost at that time when you've got your knuckleballer coming in into the game to save to get you to the next at bat. And she came back down and she said, I can't really sleep, what's going on? I go, just go back to bed. And she goes, no, she's a big, she loves Tim Wakefield. So she comes down, she takes a look at the TV, and then the Aaron Boone thing, and I just felt completely, I mean, I think like a lot of people, it just felt lost already at that point, and it just felt like a huge nail in the coffin, and I was very emotionally, until that point, this harkens back to what I was saying about my journey into being a Red Sox fan. I missed that deep pain of 86 because I didn't really care about baseball very much back then. I had been a huge baseball fan as a little kid, but had sort of lost interest when I got into rock and roll in teenagerhood. And so now I knew that pain in 2003. And I actually remember talking to Mike O'Malley, you know, who was also very involved in Hot Stove Cool Music and who's probably my best friend at this point, one of my best friends. And we were on the, you know, we would be texting during games. I don't know if we were texting back then or what, but I'm on the phone with him. And I just remember walking out of my house just to take a long walk in the night. And he was almost inconsolable. Here's a kid who grew up in, you know, bleeding the Red Sox, living and dying the Red Sox in Nashua, New Hampshire, with a Boston family, and I mean, he was devastated, and I just felt like I was talking him off the bridge.
I would have to say that I didn't have rock and roll, so it was kind of the Red Sox and the Red Sox and comic books were all I had. But I did suffer through 86, and I still think 2003 hurt more. 2003, and it wasn't even like they were as close as they were in 86. In 86, they were literally one strike away from winning the World Series. In 2003, it was really just the ALCS, probably because it was the Yankees. But it was, to your point, I was inconsolable. I hate to equate it with a human life, but it was like I lost a loved one. I was devastated, and
talking about it and listening to you as well, it really felt like we went through the seven stages of grief too, because there was a whole lot of anger. I mean, look at the name of your podcast and of your website. It's just, you know, everybody was like, first you're just like, you can't believe it. Then it's denial, and then it's depression and anger. I really felt pissed off.
There was somebody had to pay. I mean, Ned, you're right. I mean, I think Grady was obviously the scapegoat we had to point to. But the interesting thing, and you mentioned Tim Wakefield, and actually you immortalized some of that game you had created a song. You posted your site, The Ballad of Tim Wakefield, which actually paid homage to Wakefield and reference the Aaron Boone home run. But I think if it was anyone other than Wakefield, I think Wakefield, just by virtue of being Wakefield, escaped a lot of the anger, because I would imagine anyone else who was on the hill who gave up a home run that lost in ALCS to the Yankees, other than Wakefield, probably would have got it. But I think Wakefield was just so beloved, he was almost above it.
That's absolutely true, but it wasn't just that he was beloved. It was that he was being a good soldier, put into a role that's not his role. It's not where he should have been. It was the management's fault for putting him in there.
Right.
And for more to the point, for getting us to where that had to happen. So, and that's where the anger comes from. You're right. There was absolutely no anger. Everybody felt bad for Tim Wakefield.
Right.
You know?
Would you consider in your life as a Red Sox fan, would you consider that the low ebb? Was that pretty much, I mean, you didn't really have 86, so this would be probably the lowest ebb for you as a Red Sox fan.
Oh, no, without a doubt.
Now, yeah. Had that after that happened, fast forward to October 2004, would you, well, actually, one last question on 2003. After that, I honestly thought that way. My attitude was, that's it. It's never happening again. That was the closest we ever come, and it's never going to happen. I mean, did you feel similarly, or did you feel that, oh, we'll get him next year?
No, I really did feel like, I don't know, in the immediate aftermath, but I felt like we still had, I mean, I'm trying to think back. My baseball, my memory in general is not great. But baseball, in fact, I was driving home tonight listening to the game, and they were reflecting on some of the big, they were reflecting on the grand slam that, that Victorino had, I'm sorry, against the Cardinals. Uh-huh. And, but that's my point. It's like, I was there. I watched every inning, and I was present for some of those games, and yet, I'm like, oh yeah, which game was that? Oh, what happened there? Who was on the team? Oh, yeah. Even last season, my memory starts to fail already. I very much live it, but while we're in the moment there, so I'm thinking back to those 01, 02, 03 teams, and it really felt like something that was, to answer your question, that was building, and I felt like it was still on the upward swing. I mean, Pedro was clearly starting to not be Pedro anymore. He was fading a little bit, and that's why that decision hurt so much too. Everybody knew it, right. But I didn't feel like, you know, there were still a lot of young players. It wasn't like the most youthful team, but I didn't feel like, all right, now they're going to break up this team, and that's the last we're going to see, and it's going to start all over. I really felt like it was building to 2004, and I had irrational faith in the 04 team. I mean, I do remember getting to July of 04 and going, I don't think this team has what it takes once, you know, and sort of getting slapped down by another Pollyanna fan in a barn saying, you know, hush your mouth, child. And I really did start to believe it. Just like, and I'll be honest with you, last season, I was posting sort of tongue-in-cheek things about trying to sell off some of the family season tickets here and there. But I said, you got to have faith. I mean, we've got some great scrappy players here. This, you never know. And I really felt like, I mean, they gave us no reason to doubt last season, but I'm jumping ahead here. But yeah, I mean, I felt like 04, you know, going into the ALCS, I felt great. But I'm not going to lie to you and say, it felt great through the whole ALCS.
So you're sitting at home for the end of the 2003 ALCS. Where were you when they finally won the World Series in 04?
The actual winning game, I was actually at Flat Top Johnny's in Cambridge with a group of friends. We weren't sure if that would be the clinching game or not. It was game six. No, I'm sorry. They swept. It was game four.
Right.
I was in Flat Top Johnny's, and I had we for some reason we had Lenny DiNardo with us. I don't know why he wasn't with the Red Sox.
Was he that innocuous that they didn't realize he was gone at that point?
I mean, there was rumors that Tito just didn't like him, didn't want him on the team. I don't know why he wouldn't like him. He's an extremely likable boy with great taste in music, and I'm sure they didn't need him, but they had a lot of players they didn't use, so I don't know what kind of decision. Anyway, he was with us watching this game on the TV, and at the end of it, we were like, all we could do was haul Lenny up on our shoulders and march him around Flat Top. There's a picture of that. Have you ever seen a picture of that?
I actually have seen a picture of that, now that you mention that. You're right.
Yeah.
Lenny DiNardo. Lenny's night off, apparently.
Yeah, exactly.
Good thing they didn't need him. Was there ever a point in the 2004 postseason, and you've kind of alluded to this a little bit in some of the things you're just talking about, but actually, I'm not even going to say the 2004 postseason. I'm going to say, let's go back to Game 7 of the ALCS in 2004 when they beat the Yankees. Was there ever, at what point did you finally think, we got this? I know that Johnny Damon hit a couple of, we were up by a good six or seven runs, I think, by the third inning. Johnny Damon had a grand slam. It was pretty one-sided for the first number of frames there. But I still, you know, until that last out was made, I just couldn't let it go. I couldn't assume anything.
That game was a no-doubter for me. I felt confident the whole way. So this touches on a few things that we've talked about. If it wasn't for 03, game three that Saturday night, was Saturday night, I think it was, where it was 14 to whatever at Fenway. That might have been one of the lowest ebbs until they made good, you know. I mean, that blowout game, I was standing outside again with Mike O'Malley, and this time his father was there, and his father was the, you know, he's a sweetheart guy, but he had that typical defeatist Boston and never gonna do it attitude, and ha ha ha, you know, what do you kids keep putting your heart in this for, you know, blah blah blah. But he's out there on Yawkey Way with us, and I said, you know, all you need is, and I said this, I really, you know, it was half tongue in cheek because it all hope looked lost, but I said, you know, all it takes is that one game at a time, a cliche, and that's what eventually Kevin Millar came out and said that next day.
Right.
And but there's part of me that is the eternal kid optimist that doesn't want to let, you know, the crusty old man beat him down, and I truly kind of had a glimmer of hope in there, and I went to all those games at home in the ALCS, and again, talking about the memorable moments for me, I eventually got all those, you know, those games on iTunes or whatever, and watched them over and over again that off season. Maybe that's why it's burned in my memory. But we had great seats for the Dave Roberts steal. We were just above the Yankees dugout. In fact, Reggie Jackson was in the row behind us.
Nice.
Actually, he was standing in the aisle between us, and we were standing up during an exciting part of the game. The only O'Malley could get these kind of tickets, by the way, of course. So I'm privileged enough to be his guest, and one of the red jacketed ushers taps me on my shoulder and comes up and says, "Would you mind sitting down?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "Well, Reggie Jackson here can't see." And I said, "You tell Reggie he's in our house." And I told that to Horrigan, and he printed it in the Herald the next day. But I remember vividly, just looking, we were almost on the same plane as Dave Roberts, and I don't recall ever seeing a lead that far off of first base. I mean, everybody knew he was going. He almost got caught, almost got picked off, rather. And then when he went, just going, "Oh my God, he's out," you know, and just seeing him sneak right in there and make that face where he went, "Woo!" And just thinking, that's it. That's the turning point. I mean, maybe not that, but when Bill Miller came up, right? Or Millar got the hit and then Miller got him home, or was Millar on third?
Millar got the walk. Before the steal, there was the walk. He got the walk, and then they put Roberts in for him at first base.
That's right, okay, yeah. And Billy Miller got him home. And then thinking, okay, it's now we've got momentum on our side. But each of those games was, and I'm not the first to use that analogy, but the heavyweight fight. I mean, I felt personally like, you know, I had been pummeled in my kidneys by the end of some of the, when the Ortiz walk-off hit, you know, bloop. Oh, God. It was just relief more than anything else. Yeah.
That was the interesting thing about that whole stretch of games, and you were there, so I'm sure you experienced even more so, was I don't remember ever sleeping for like that stretch of 12 days. I mean, it was basically you were almost living, you couldn't sleep. I mean, I was almost afraid to sleep. I thought I might have been dreaming that these things were happening, you know.
Just trying to get out of Fenway and, you know, and drinking after the game and then trying to get home and, and then getting up for the next day. In fact, it's funny, another funny story, and O'Malley would probably hate me for telling this story, but, you know, he's flying back and forth from the West Coast. He's got kids going, you know, he's got a real adult responsibilities. And after that Saturday game on the Sunday, after the blowout, on Sunday he called me and said, you're gonna take my two tickets. I gotta get back. And I go, no, you're not. You're gonna use it. I said, don't make any decisions. You got plenty of time till game time. You know, you're coming. And he did. And then he stuck around for each game afterwards. But, to your point, just completely running on fumes. So you're sort of giddy as well.
And it was almost, I would say that the ALCS win over the Yankees was actually, it feels so wrong to say this, but it almost felt like the Yankees win was bigger than the World Series. I mean, the World Series obviously was big. It was huge. It was the elusive brass ring. But man, after I beat the Yankees, I can probably name every second of every play that happened in those last four games of the ALCS. All I can really recall from the World Series is that we won, you know.
Well, that one in 07 as well. I mean, those sweeps just felt like an absolute cakewalk after getting through, you know, the ALCS. Absolutely. And it was a complete anticlimactic. But, I mean, you know, to say you won it, I mean, it felt like we won the World Series after those seven games.
Yeah, it's exactly what it felt like. And if you went back to 2003, if the baseball gods came to you after that Aaron Boone game and said, "Bill, what can we do to make this up to you?" You can't say that you wouldn't have said, "I want them to go up three games and I want to take that." Was that not perfect though? It was perfect.
Oh, the first thing I did was try to find WFAN, Mike and the Mad Dog, the next day online, so I could just revel in the shaving fluid of it all. And they opened up with this, I don't know if you've ever heard it, but they opened up with this epic montage of the collapse, and it was just so sweet. The greatest collapse of all time, the greatest comeback of all time in sports history. I mean, it was just, and I said, this is, I think you said, at one point, it was one of the greatest moments of your life. I said this in front of my wife once. I said, "That month was the greatest month of my life." And she said, "And then your son was born in November, right?" Yes, it lasted for exactly 1 month.
But it does rank up there. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned ranking among the greatest moments of your life, because it really, it is. I mean, it sounds so, I mean, to people who aren't as obsessive about, not just the Red Sox, but sports in general, I suppose it seems foreign to them. But to me, it was. It was one of the biggest, I mean, I'd have to rank it right up there with some of, you know, it was a life-changing event for me in many ways.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine, well, I can, but it, you know, for me alone, and being sort of a fair, not a fair weather, but a sort of a bit of a Johnny come lately fan, you know, I had been a casual fan since the 80s, since I moved up here. I mean, I went to Fenway, one of the first things I did when I moved to the Boston area. But for people that grew up like you in Boston, rooting for these guys as a kid, I can't even imagine how elated you must have felt.
It didn't even really make sense, to be honest with you. And my dad passed in 2006, but I keep saying, thank God he was around to see it in 2004, man, because at least seeing one of them, I mean, if he was around to see all three of them, he would have truly felt like he was living in an alternate universe. He would have felt like he would have thought he slipped through the time space continuum and he was in some other world. But to have seen it happen once, and it doesn't even make sense. It was actually kind of leads into the question I was going to ask you next, which is, I mean, does it, maybe not so much in your case because you kind of, I mean you've been in Red Sox Nation obviously long enough to share the pain. I mean, I grew up with it, but does, I often wonder if 2004 and then subsequent success in 2007 and 2013. I mean, are we spoiled? I mean, are we losing that one? You know, we used to always been identifiable by our, you know, the miserable Boston fans, and now it's almost like I feel bad if I write a blog post saying, "Man, I wish, you know, Jackie Bradley Jr. didn't ground into that double play." I mean, it's tough to say something bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, for me, as the somewhat detached observer of it for so many years, like, I went to college, high school and college with kids that, you know, grew up in Eastern Massachusetts and in the Boston area, and they were entitled fans, you know, like, they felt like since the Celtics were so good, I mean, you know, I'm not a huge sports fan in general. I'm very much a baseball fan, and I'm a casual fan of everything else. But even as a baseball fan, I'm more of a Red Sox fan than somebody that can tell you what's going on with every team in each division.
Right.
But you know, I felt like, man, what these are arrogant fans. They just feel like they deserve this. Meanwhile, there's, you know, there's plenty of teams that haven't won in decades. But I think there was this certain thing. It's like, hey, we're, you know, this is where the boss, this is where we get championships. This is where the Bruins were, the big bad Bruins, and this is where the Celtics have put up so many championship banners. But the Red Sox were this weak spot. But, you know, your question is, are we spoiled now? I mean, I think everybody was spoiled beforehand, but as Red Sox fans specifically, no. I mean, I just feel like it's just a different era. I mean, it really comes down to the ownership and the philosophy and the science behind the game, and it just makes you realize how poorly put together those other teams were, and just the sort of outdated philosophy about putting together a team.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, I remember a time when I actually thought having Dante Bichette in the lineup was going to be a difference maker. So you're right, I think it's...
Oh, Dante Bichette and Carl Everett? Oh, my God, those were some dark years right there, man. The year that Joe Kerrigan became general manager.
Yeah, it was. We truly are through the looking glass. I mean, it really is. It is. It's like an alternate reality, you know? It almost doesn't make sense how... It is almost an embarrassment of riches, and I'm very much like you in that I grew up in a house that all my dad ever watched was the Red Sox. So myself and my siblings, my dad didn't watch the Celtics or the Patriots or the Bruins. I mean, he may have, you know, been, to your point, to use your phrase, kind of a casual observer of those sports, but it was baseball all the time in my house, and it was Red Sox baseball. You know, I couldn't tell you, you know, who the NL batting champs were, or who the, you know, the top five base stealers were in the American League, but we knew everything about the Red Sox. It was like a religion in our house. So, you know, to grow up with that and then to have all these horrific things continue to befall you, you do get the impression that, all right, well, someone up there obviously doesn't want this to work. So, you know, Sure. We'll just keep on rooting and just brace ourselves for the inevitable disappointment. But seeing it all come together, it's still, I do often find myself saying, I can't believe, did this shit actually happen? Even on the, you know, you see, I was watching the ESPN documentary 4 Days in October, which is spectacular. They dissect the last four games of the 2004 ALCS, the last four games, and it really is amazing that it, you know, to your point, you know, the steal happens and suddenly there's the shift in momentum and everything just, you know, you couldn't script it. I know it sounds cliche, but you honestly couldn't have written that. If someone wrote that and brought it to a Hollywood producer, they would have said, "Get out of here with that. It doesn't make any sense." But
absolutely, it really felt like the world shifted on its axis at that moment. But I mean, these are the over exaggerations of people that are just completely self-involved in this thing, or not self-involved so much as just like myopically involved in this little sport. Because yeah, I mean, I remember the time where in 86 where I could just watch it as a guy in a bar and go, okay, what are we doing now, you know, after the game, you know, but then you get yourself emotionally involved. And I have to say, I mean, I can trace a lot of my interest in the Red Sox to the fact that, I really look at it as like this. We were on the road so much as a band during the 90s, and so I wasn't around to see a lot of those games. But what I was doing is going from city to city and seeing them root for, you know, in New Zealand, the All Blacks or rugby team, or, you know, seeing generations of families rooting for Chelsea, you know, soccer in London, and right, and going to those games and really having an appreciation for it, and being with friends over there that and people that we worked with who had these fandom, and it made me appreciate. It's sort of like that old cliche, you know, it's like your old hometown, and you never know what you got until it's gone, kind of thing, or until you're away. And there really was a bit of that. So when I would come home, I would get really into the games, just watching them. And I remember sitting there with an Australian tour manager we had and explaining the game of baseball to him. And he was a huge cricket guy, uh-huh, and he was totally engrossed in the game. And so I gathered this impression, appreciation for it, and this emotional attachment to it, and then to the underdog aspect, and really how it all tied in together with the psyche of the city. And I felt all of a sudden like, okay, now I really am a Bostonian after being a guy that I thought of himself as a New Yorker transplant. So I think once you get in, you sort of buy into that underdog thing, and then when they start to win, it does challenge your perception, absolutely, and your self-perception, but it also makes you just happy that you believed, because you didn't just follow the games because you wanted to be the loser. You followed the games because you really thought there was a chance that they could have pulled this out.
Right.
That eventually Lucy was not going to pull away the football.
That's an interesting point, and it's interesting to think that basically powered an entire city. That stretch of games there, you're right. It was the idea that, you know, you don't, for all the bad luck we had, and for all the, you know, the talk of curses and how this team will never win, we did believe. And I think when Curt Schilling said things like, why not us? I think it did get people thinking, at some point, why couldn't it happen? You know, and I think you're right. It was interesting to see it all. Everyone kind of rallied behind that. And it was not just a great time for the Red Sox, but it was a great time for the city. And it was a great time to, people were friendly and they were actually kind of nice to each other. You know, it was interesting.
And it really had to do with outsiders coming in, I think, not just the players like Schilling, but that ownership group that we still have. And I'm not saying that they're the most perfect and I love them and blah, 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 but it really, I think during those last of the Duquette years and that kind of weird trust ownership of Harrington and all that, it was a surly team from like top to bottom, and the players were mercenary for the most part, and very rarely did you have a guy, and the first guy I felt like the first guy I really felt changed that to me while I was watching him, and there were probably other players that you felt like this about growing up, but it was Pedro, a guy that really came out and was gonna felt like he deserved it, you know, and wasn't
right.
gonna buy into this oh woe is me Boston is cursed bullshit, you know,
right?
And that's why he's to this day he'll probably, you know, for my life he'll always be my favorite player, because I felt like he brought that swagger to Boston way before, like, and it was an entitlement. I felt like this is the guy that's going to deliver us, and so that's what made it that much more painful during that 03 season and the way that went down, you know.
Right. We did, you're right about Pedro. We did kind of base everything around Pedro. It was almost like the Pedro countdown. Well, he has so many good years left in him. We got to, you know, because we just assumed if there was going to be any overthrowing of the castle, this was the guy who was going to be leading the march, you know. So we had to make it happen. Last question I have for you. If you were asked to sort of sum up the last 10 years as a Red Sox fan from 2004 to 2009 in a couple of words, a couple of sentences, how would you basically sum up your experience as a Red Sox fan over the last 10 years?
You know, I saw this question and I'm thinking, all right, some answer will come to me eventually. I don't know that I get. I mean, I for me personally, it feels like it's been falling in deeper and deeper this whole time. It's like, there was the 2012 season where I actually was writing that second Stones book, and they were awful from start to finish, and that was one season where I felt like, you know what, I don't need to care that deeply about this team. But for the most part, I just feel like it's been, as I get older, and you should sort of have more emotional detachment from a bunch of guys getting paid crazy amounts of money to just wear your laundry, I just feel like more and more involved. And, you know, I will say this, and this is, you asked me to do a couple sentences, and it's just not my style. As you can see, I ramble on. But
just roll.
but, I mean, I'm not the most concise, concise guy, but I just think that, seeing that, this kind of harkens back to what I was saying a little earlier about having faith in that 2013 team. It's like, it really felt like that 03-04 team again to me. Like, you know, the beards, whatever it was. But it was really sort of a happy-go-lucky, we don't believe in the past kind of thing. We're here to win. And it's guys like Johnny Gomes who came with that reputation of being on, you know, he's a winner. He's a guy that's a good clubhouse guy, and he's on winning teams. And it's, I don't know. I don't know what it's felt like. I just feel like it's been a long emotional journey for nothing else, you know?
And it has. has been. It's been and interesting bookends too. I mean, you had 2004, which was very therapeutic after 2003, and then interestingly, you have last year, which was, some would argue, it was just kind of what the city needed at that point. You know, it was on the heels from the ashes of that 2012 season that, you know, even the players checked out halfway through the year. You know, they made the decision they pretty much didn't want to work with Valentine, and that was it. So it was two interesting bookends there between 04 and last year's team.
Not to mention the marathon bombings and how that galvanized the city as well.
Yeah, so it's been very. This year, I think, was last year's World Series is one of those pleasant surprises. I mean, after 2004 and 2007, I was content to just say, you know what, I'm fat and happy at this point. Two more World Series than I thought I'd see in my lifetime, and you know, last year was just was a storybook. You know, it was. Every bit as meaningful as the others, but all of them very unique and different. And it's been awesome. After I sent you the question, I was thinking the same thing. Like, I don't even know how the fuck I'd answer that, to be honest with you. I have no idea. I really don't know, other than much better than the 10 previous years, I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been better in that regard. So, well, that's all I had. Bill, I do very much appreciate you taking the time to chat with us about the horrors of 2003 and the eventual uplift of 2004. For anyone who has, I can't imagine, if you're in Boston, you should have at least one Buffalo Tom CD, but they're all out there. BillJanovitz.com. Is where you can check out his blog, and he posts lots of music there as well. We mentioned the Stones book and also the Paradise. Come on, you got to get out to the Dice. On June 21st, Buffalo Tom will be playing the Paradise, and you guys we don't get a lot of Buffalo. We're not blessed with as many Buffalo Tom shows these days, so each one is an important event, so we must rally, and we must be there for that. Any surprises we can look forward to?
No, we are doing two sets for the first time. I think that, you know, we're sort of doing like an evening with kind of thing where we're doing an acoustic, maybe a quieter set to begin with, and then taking a little break and then getting more into the rock. I think that's the plan. But we're definitely doing two sets.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tim.